Thank you very much to Professor Bachtel and Professor Ossola for the very, very kind invitation and organization of a whole day dealing with an issue that preoccupied me for years. I would like to give you at the beginning only the framework of my discussion, and then I shall speak about spatial text. My discussion today will deal with some form of music, but that is part of a project which is based also on my lectures at the Collège de France, which was published and mentioned earlier, in which I would like to point out the importance of the verbal performed text of the Bible or of prayer. Which means that more than a contemplation of a certain form of the text or a mental performance, meaning reading, in traditional Judaism, what was more important was the verbal performance. Meaning we are using the term studying Torah, but the term study doesn't mean a mental performance, but much more a discussion, which means that by shifting from the visual to the verbal, maybe we have another phenomenology of Judaism. Not a religion of the book, but a religion of the verbal performance of the book. That is quite obvious in the case of reading the Torah, which means loud reading and not just mental absorption of the content. That is also the case of the study of the Talmud, which is always loud. And that's also the case of prayer, which is never mental prayer, but always verbal performance, loud verbal performance, which seems to me to point to another vision than the contemplative, meditative approach to what is important. It's much more how do you pronounce together, how a certain form of atmosphere is created by people performing together a text, rather than sitting and reading or contemplating. So that is the general framework. In my opinion, at least in Rabbinic Judaism, maybe earlier, it's not just the book which is important, but the way in which the book was performed. Now, one way to discuss it is to look to the role of music, because performance was never done without a certain form of melody. There is actually a melody in which the Talmud is read. I mean, you perform it, but you perform it in a certain form of psalmody. So music is part of a certain way of verbal performance. This musical aspect has to do with some form of mnemotechnics, how to remember easier by having a certain melody while you are performing loudly. For sure, the prayer has a certain form of melody. So music is one dimension of the verbal performance, which is done either for aesthetical, not so important, or for mnemotechnic aspects. But by attempting to emphasize the verbal, we must take in consideration also the musical aspect of this performance. Today, I would like to deal with one tradition dealing with musical performance. But this tradition should be also understood in the context of two events, if you like. One initiated by Professor Ossola some years ago at Academia del Lincei when dealing with memory. So then I started to read a little bit about memory, and today that's one of the results of this conference there, which is maybe chapter 3 in a book on Jewish memory. And the other aspect is related to Professor Wachtel, who just published a translation of the book on memory and faith of the Maranos. So I don't know if you've seen the book, the English version, which was just published here. So I'm also contributing something modest to the idea of memory. Now, let me start with a short discussion of ancient Judaism. In ancient Judaism, we can find an important idea, which was not discussed for the time being, about the continuous singing and praising of the angels. So in ancient Judaism, angels were supposed much more than being messengers of God. They are supposed to be a chorus singing and praising God all the time. That is found also in ancient Christianity, but it is much more developed in ancient Judaism, and that's a whole topic, which I believe we can write a whole book, about the angelic chorus, even angelic orchestra, even an angelic conductor, and how it is done. It's a topic which seems to me to be fascinating, very important for my point here, because that is a personal type of religion. Meaning the angels are singing to God as a persona, they have a conductor, and that's a scenario, very human scenario. Nothing cosmical here. It's much more God needs this form of continuous praising, and the angels are supplying it. We are also joining from time to time by prayer, but it is supposed to be continuous on high, not only 3 times a day while praying, but it's supposed to be all the time. God needs this form of continuous chorus. And in fact, a lot of events related to accidents, like the fall of angels. What happened? The angels are falling, which actually happened. So the chorus has a problem. So that is the whole book that I don't know if I shall be able to write it sometime, but I have a lot of material on it. So that's a personal celestial music. This is not only psalmody. There is also instrumental music there. But again, that's a whole topic which I cannot address here. There's a personalistic approach. My first text that I would like to discuss here is for sure stemming from a totally different mentality. And that's a text of Iamblichus, a very important late Neoplatonist, but unusual Neoplatonist, which is much more magically inclined. And the Iamblichus is actually maybe bringing together, maybe expressing an earlier vision, which can be described as follows. We have Plato's vision of anamnesis, which means the soul remembers what the ideas, not music, on high while it is here. That is philosophy, to return and to remember. But without music, to my best knowledge. And another tradition, which is maybe earlier than Plato, which is the Pythagorean tradition, speaking about the music of the spheres. Now, Plato may be neutralized aspects of Pythagorean traditions. That's not my idea. That is found in Professor Vernon reading of memory and another scholar saying that Plato actually was acquainted with Pythagoras for sure and Orphic religion, but he wanted to give something less mythological. So what we have in Iamblichus, who is a Neoplatonist, but also a Neo-Pythagorean vision, he is bringing together two existing traditions, which maybe were separated, maybe they were together earlier. Which means that the music of the spheres is part of the harmony of the human soul. And when someone is listening to music here below, remembers the anamnesis, the music heard by the soul before it descended in this world. So in Iamblichus, this combination of cosmic music with anamnesis is obvious. For many reasons, I don't believe that Iamblichus is the first. And that's less important now to deal with if he's really the first or not, because there are in Plutarchus, there are some hints which maybe indicate the existence of a synthesis earlier than Iamblichus. But what is important here, that's a cosmic religiosity. Nothing like a personal God, no angels, but a natural affinity between the human soul and the cosmos. And that's why, after the fall of the soul in the body, by listening to music, the soul is able to return to the initial pre-existential moment in which the soul listened to the cosmic music. I would like to emphasize the cosmic music. So we have two different religious visions. One, the Jewish one, with the chorus and the personal deity, and the human participation in the celestial music on the one side. And on the other side, we have the cosmic religiosity of Pythagoras and Plato, and then Iamblichus, which is for sure independent on Jewish sources and vice versa. What is important from my point of view is the fact that in Kabbalah we can find a combination of the two. And I would like to discuss this combination and this tradition and the implications of this combination for understanding Judaism, not only Kabbalah. So early in the 14th century, we don't know exactly when, apparently in Spain, a Kabbalist, relatively unknown, named Joseph Angelet, not a very original figure, mentions a certain tradition, which I would like to quote and analyze, because here we can see the two traditions together. That is number two in the handout. I skip the first text, meaning it's quite obvious for me that the Kabbalists depend on Arabic sources. There's not only the text I brought here, there are a variety of other texts, like Ikhwan al-Safa and other eclectic doxographical Arabic sources, where you can see the transition from a Iamblichus type of synthesis toward the Middle Ages. So I don't claim that the Kabbalists were here original. On the contrary, what is interesting in the Kabbalistic text is the attempt to bring together two different forms of religions. So, Joseph Angelet, capitalizing on some form of Arabic sources, and not on, directly on Iamblichus, which was relatively unknown in the Middle Ages, is saying as follows. And you have a translated text in French. And when someone wants to arise to the Torah in prayer, meaning?
Numéro 3.
Excuse me?
Non, c'est numéro 3. Là.
Number three, excuse me. So when someone wants to rise to the Torah in prayer, meaning the topic is obviously Jewish, how do you arise, meaning how do you perform prayer and Torah? So that is his problem. What is the meaning of reading, performing, or the Hebrew text arising? So that is the pretext of bringing the Iamblichus type of tradition. In order that the Holy Spirit will dwell upon her, upon the soul. This is the idea. Reading the Torah or praying is basically a technique for bringing down the divine presence on someone. So the question is, and what is to arouse? And here starts the part, which is, in my opinion, the reverberation of Iamblichus. And when the player played and the spirit was upon him, that's a biblical verse, because the soul is derived from above. So that's the Platonic story. The soul has a preexistence, and given the fact that preexisted, it had some form of harmony or knowledge. So it's derived from above, from the bundle of life, that's a biblical term, and she is accustomed with melodies and with songs of the servant angels. Have melodies, which is, in my opinion, the harmony of Plato, Pythagoras, on the other side, the servant angels, which is the Jewish tradition. Here you can see two traditions brought together without distinguishing between them, and the song of the spheres. You can see how, in the Middle Ages, the Greek Hellenistic tradition is combined with the ancient Jewish tradition. But now, when she, the soul, is within the body, and she listens to melodies, meaning melodies here below, then she takes pleasure and delight as she was accustomed when she was cleaving to its root, meaning that is a technique for return to the source. Music is not just an aesthetic experience, it's much more a mystical experience, in which we have here two ideals. One ideal is to bring down, the other ideal is to return to the source. So that's not a very systematic way of writing. It's in fact a conflict. And the Kabbalists were not great systematical thinkers, and they operated in a very complex field in which Greek theories and Jewish theories should be combined, and that's what happens. And on the one side, you bring down, on the other side, you have to ascend by the same melodies. Cleaving to the source, to the delight of the voice of the sphere. So here you can see Pythagoras in a very strong way, but you can see also Plato with the idea of the memory. And out of the pleasure and enjoyment, she merits the Spirit of God to dwell upon her. And it happened in her first root, as it happened in the first root. Meaning that's a return to the origin. So I shall use here a term to which I shall return later on. That is a nostalgia of the origins. Music is creating this form of nostalgia, inducing a certain feeling that the soul was pre-existing and listening in the paradisical situation when the soul was part of its root. Then the music of the spheres was available, and the music of the angels was available. And that is related not to a mental experience, and not just a verbal performance, but to a melodical performance. So here, for sure, there is a verbal aspect, Torah and prayer, but there must be also some form of melodical performance. So here we can see two traditions, which are, in my opinion, quite obvious in its elements, combined in a rather, I would say, primitive form, without attempting to harmonize between them. Because you can see you bring down, you ascend, exactly in the same text, without attempting to reflect on the conflict between bringing God here below or ascending to the source, which conflict, in my opinion. Now, here we can see, in fact, to anticipate a little bit, not a messianic eschatology, but there's a personal eschatology. Is the soul alone returning to its source, nothing like history? That is the basic experience described in this text. Now, Angelet, as I mentioned, was for sure not an original Kabbalist. He's, how to put it in comparison to other great Kabbalists, for sure eclectical, attempting to illustrate a variety of ideas by using earlier texts, and that seems to me to be the case also here. But the importance of this non-original Kabbalist is that it became the source of a Kabbalistic tradition. Almost all the other Kabbalists dealing with it are quoting in one way or another this text, which was basically unknown but to one Kabbalist, and then from that other Kabbalist, Angelet was quoted. Meaning, I would like not to enter now on the whole history of the quotation of this text. I have, for the time being, something like 10 cases of using this text in a variety of places. At Spain, you can find it in the Ottoman Empire, you can find it in Safed, you can find it in Italy, in Mantua, and then in Modena, and then it's a lot of Kabbalists who were very, very fond of this tradition. Which means that we have here the birth of a tradition with Angelet, a tradition which explains now the basic experience in Judaism, Torah and prayer, by using some form of Pythagoreanism, maybe Orphism, via a certain form of Platonic interpretation with anamnesis, to remember what happened in the pre-existence of the soul in on high. So one example is found in Aaron Brahe of Modena, an early 17th century a Kabbalist, also not very original, but widespread text. And there you can see a variant, basically, not very original too. He copied it from another Kabbalist, which I didn't bring here, named Merim Gabay, early 16th century in the Ottoman Empire, who copied Angelet, and via him Gabay, which was a book was immediately printed and then disseminated. Also, Aaron Brahe of Modena knew about Angelet. So here we have, there is a palace on high that is hidden. It's some barrier then in comparison to Angelet. It is not opened but by means of the melody. And the soul is taking pleasure from the melody because it is accustomed to melodies, the song of the servant angels and the song of the spheres. You can see verbatim quotations. And when she is in the body and listens to melodies, she is taking pleasure as she is accustomed when she was cleaving to her root. And after her great joy, she merits that the Spirit of God will dwell according to her behavior on root. You can see how some 400 years after Angelet, you find the same story with small variants. As I mentioned, he's not the only one. We have other Kabbalists, which means, from my point of view, that the Pythagorean Platonic synthesis was not quoted once by a Kabbalist, but it became a Kabbalistic tradition. It became, in, I would say, several major cases, also people who were on the verge of Kabbalah, like the famous Yehuda Moscato, who was very interested in music, is using Angelet text in a Renaissance context, which I would like not to discuss here. But here we have already a tradition, meaning people from a variety of Jewish communities, a variety of intellectual contexts, are referring to it as something obvious. Another quote from Shlomo Alevi Alkabetz, a very influential Kabbalist, in Safed, maybe we have a slightly different source that I couldn't find, where the same idea is expressed, and I don't know if he copied or he had another Kabbalistic source, but here is actually one of the most orthodox Kabbalists we can imagine, adopting the Pythagorean Platonic combination in Jewish sources. So he is bringing tradition and oral tradition. He heard from an old man. I believe he is giving a correct report. He doesn't invent. I mean, like in many other occasions, he had sources which he doesn't identify. And there you can see why melody and music are pleasant to the soul. Because she was accustomed to listen to it on high. It is known to whomever does not deny the meaning of the biblical verses. Here you can see Plato and Pythagoras are becoming the clue for understanding biblical verses. That's not just, how to put it, a certain form of ontology. That is the clue of a series of verses in the Bible. Because without understanding it, you don't understand what's written in the Bible. And he is discussing, actually, later on, how by listening to music and songs, someone returns to the pleasure in the original state. So, last but not least, that's the text of Lermontov, which I don't know how, he is also expressing very clearly the traditions I'm speaking here, but I would like not to enter Lermontov, but to return to some Neo-Latin author now in this context. The exercise I proposed earlier can be summarized in such a way. There was a Jewish tradition and there was a Greek tradition. Kabbalists who are very, very orthodox could easily adopt a Greek tradition, knowing or not knowing what the source is, and transform, in fact, the practice of Judaism, meaning studying the Torah and prayer with melodies, on the basis of the Pythagorean Platonic tradition, which involves, in a very clear way, the idea of anamnesis, meaning what is the real experience of someone? To return to the source, return of the soul to the source, which is anamnesis, what I called musical anamnesis. Which means originality is not so important here. What is much more important is the possibility of appropriation, of learning from sources, which I believe are Arabic sources, ultimately Greek and Hellenistic sources, to learn, adapt, and change. That is, to a great extent, the history of Judaism. Not always original ideas, not very many original ideas, but learning from a variety of sources in an eclectic, non-systematic, casual, accidental way. Ideas which were appropriated because they serve a certain way of understanding what is Torah and what is prayer. That is, to a great extent, the history of Judaism. There is a certain praxis that was important. We have explanations of the practice. The explanation can come from a variety of sources. Less important the source, more important that those explanations strengthen strengthened the performance of the Jewish text. Now, if you are going to read one of the most important, maybe the most important, Phenomenology of Religion in the 20th century, offered not far away from here, by the invitation of Professor of Collège de France in 1946-1948, offered by Mircea Eliade at École d'Hautétude, he offered a Phenomenology of Religion, which became the clue for his history of religion, which means that we have, in fact, two basic lines in the history of religion. One is what he called the archaic religiosity, and the other one is the Jewish-Christian, historically oriented religion. The archaic religion is related, in his opinion, he's using the term, anamnesis, which means the soul is returning continuously to the source. This continuous return is a renewal. That's a refuse to enter history, because history is, for him, terror. And unlike the Jewish or Jewish-Christian, and I would like not to enter now in the problems, Jewish-Christian tradition, which is historically oriented, a linear time, not going back, we have, in fact, the two religions, in fact. And he insists since 1946-1948, especially 1949, when he published The Myth of Eternal Return, he insisted on it all the time, that, in fact, those two lines differ dramatically. And what he attempted to do is to say, look, we must return to what I believe he thought is the original religion, the archaic, anti-historical, or ahistorical religion, which is the religion of the archaic man, peasant, etc. His basic assumption is that there is one line in the Jewish-Christian tradition, which is the non-circular, non-anamnetic, no return to the source, but going to the end, toward the end, all the time. So what I attempted to do here is to show that, in fact, it is misleading to attempt to describe Judaism, in my opinion, any other religion which developed for a long period, by using strong phenomenologies, as if that's impossible for those people to learn and change, and create a dichotomy between what is an original, and he believes that Plato, Eliade, is writing very openly. Plato is not the beginning of a line. He is the end of the archaic vision of man. He's claiming that Plato's archetype is actually the end of the development of the archaic man, and he only formulated a certain ontology, which was forgotten, in my opinion, in his opinion. So what I attempted to do here is to show, and that's just one example, that exactly the term that he believes that's quintessential for the archaic religiosity of returning all the time to the source by anamnesis, and in such a way obliterating history, that is the meaning for him. When you return to the source, you forget about history. You don't participate in history. You escape history. That's a nostalgia for the paradise. Such a nostalgia for the paradise can be exemplified by the text I brought here, but believe me, I can bring more and more texts about this nostalgia for the paradise in Kabbalistic sources, Jewish philosophical sources, and for sure in Hasidism, which means that the phenomenology proposed by Eliade as to existence of two strongly, starkly different lines, collapses when you start to study texts and the variety of expressions in Judaism, and I believe that's also the case in Christianity. Lermontov is just one example, but there are also other examples. That also in Christianity you can find this anamnesis. So that is an example for a need to return to another phenomenology of religion, which is first more historical, more variegated, speaking much more about interactions, and not divide almost in a Manichaean way between two forms of religion which existed, but in fact also were in a constant struggle. I would like not to enter in this theory, but he's using very strong terms, terror of history. We're speaking about strong terms, meaning the two traditions are actually in constant conflict. The archaic man that he discovered is for him forgotten, suppressed by the Jewish Christian modern tradition, which is historical oriented and attempting to obliterate the archaic religion. Such a Manichaean dualistic approach to the study of religion seems to me to be a philosophical exercise done in abstracto without using actually texts from the traditions. When you return to those texts, you can see that the situation is much more complex, in my opinion, much more interesting. And what I proposed by using this text on anamnesis is to show that despite the wide impact of the phenomenology as formulated by Eliade and widespread in many, many, many books, hard to even to count the numbers of the books which accepted something like that, a more modest phenomenology which is based on eclecticism, synthesis, accidental encounters, will provide a more practical, in my opinion, better refined understanding of the tradition. If his theory about the archaic man ever existed, it's a story which I cannot enter here. But for sure I can tell you that Kabbalists were using this form of musical anamnesis in order to return to this nostalgia of the paradise, which became for him very, very important for his time of religion, that is as Kabbalistic as it is archaic. And by supplying those examples, and in my opinion also others, in which music is not involved, you can have anamnesis only without music, by just studying the Torah, because according to Jewish texts, the Torah was studied before the soul descended here below. And just by studying Torah, not without music, you can return to the paradisical existence. That is, in my opinion, a basic vision in rabbinic Judaism. And to a great extent, questions, I believe, invalidate the phenomenology of religion as practiced by, I would say, a long series of scholars of religion. And if this example will serve questioning this very strong dualistic approach, it is more than enough for me. Thank you very much.
Est-ce qu'on demande au public s'il a des questions à poser ?
Oui. Oh non, oui.
Je crois que cet exposé si important et si riche, avec aussi une position de méthode très clair qui fera évidemment méditer d'abord et discuter après, mériterait en effet une petite discussion, après quoi nous pouvons faire une pause. Je voudrais souligner que certains textes qui ont été lus en anglais, vous les avez en français dans l'exemplaire, d'autres n'ont pas été lus, mais contribuent à la thèse que Moshe Hidel vient de nous poser, qui met en discussion toute une partie de l'histoire de l'historiographie. Et je crois que c'est aussi sur ce point qu'on pourrait aborder quelques thèmes parmi ceux qui ont été évoqués d'une manière si aiguë et si brillante par Moshe Hidel que je remercie beaucoup. Mais d'abord, Nathan.
Je réitère mes remerciements que j'avais dit au début, après cet exposé qui nous laisse justement tout songeur en suivant les suggestions que Moshe nous a justement indiquées. Et je crois que en ce qui concerne les questions, l'une de celles qui me viennent à l'esprit, c'est on redemande encore quelques compléments concernant ce conflit entre les deux orientations, des deux modèles, si je peux dire, types de religion. Alors, l'archaïque est celle qui est orientée vers l'histoire. Alors là, c'est tellement fondamental que il y a des encyclopédies inépuisables qui n'épuiseront pas justement le sujet, mais quelques commentaires supplémentaires, par exemple.
I cannot enter here in a long history of how Eliade arrived to this dualism. In fact, it has to do with books written in French in the 30s here in Paris, published by Goettner, and that they arrived to Romania. Eliade wrote some reviews on them. I shall give you one example. And that's the way in which it emerged. So the important example is that you may know that at the beginning of the century, of the previous century, people found some text in Elephantine, in some Israelite text in Aramaic, which were polytheistic. That was a big discovery, and scholars wrote books, one of them written in Paris, about the polytheistic Jews in 4th century before Common Era, in which we have two alternatives. One, polytheistic Jews, the other one, the monotheistic Jews in Palestine versus Elephantine in Egypt. Eliade read such one of those books, and wrote a review in Romanian, quoting his sources, for sure. This is a review. And we can see the origin. In fact, there were two modalities. One modality was popular religion, what's called the archaic religion, also the Jewish one, in the Elephantine and also in Palestine. And the other one, the elite monotheistic religiosity in Jerusalem. That is found in books that Eliade read as a very young man. And he extrapolated from these two forms of religion found in Palestine the following history. A violent elite in Jerusalem destroyed the idolatrous vision found in Palestine, and created monotheism. Here is the source of the two religions. One, popular, concrete, idolatrous, archaic, but Israelite. And the other one is the elite, For him, elite is the prophets. I don't enter in if it's true or not, that's a long story. He created an elite, which in my opinion didn't exist. But that is another story. But that is the typology. After he found this typology, he included also Hindu peasants and Romanian ones, and he developed these two lines into a phenology which became actually Iliad. The idea was that the monotheistic vision is a violent one, that the terror of history. While the peasants and the archaic one were people attempting to live in the cosmos, not in abstract ideas, not in history, not in monotheism. And that's the history that which can be traced, in my opinion, very easy if you read his reviews of books. Where you have dates, you know exactly what book he used, what passages in a certain book he found that's important. And you can see how the phenomenology of religion we are using today starts from some orientalistic books published by Goethner, not far away from here, reviewed by Eliade, and then developed more and more and more, up to 47, when he started to review the books in 36, 7. 48, 9, he published The Myth of the Return, which became actually the articulation of those two modalities. He returned to it almost eternally in his writings, but never modified it. And in a book I hope to finish sometime, I shall show exactly how the phases of his phenomenology can be found. Since I am not interested in strong phenomenologies, but in much more reading text, I see very easy to reject something like that. Because the Jews remained the monotheistic, fanatic, violent elite in Palestine up to his day. He's using the same terms to describe the Jews in Romania. Exactly the same terms as if the Jews in Palestine remained unchangeable for 2 millennia. So that's a very strong phenomenology, which can be easily traced and also can be demolished by using those examples and many other examples dealing exactly with what he believes it is characteristic of the archaic man, the anamnesis, the return to the source all the time and the refuse to enter history. That he entered history more than many other scholars of religion, that is another story.
Un grand merci. Moi aussi, je voulais poser une question. C'est plutôt une curiosité, puisque cet après-midi, je citerai un exemple parallèle de Jean de la Croix. Dans l'exemplier au numéro 5, donc Shlomo Alkabetz, voilà, dans la partie B, il y a toute une, comment dirais-je, une phénoménologie de comportement. Des âmes qui vont aimer cela. Alors, il y a des âmes qui s'endorment. Hein. Il y a d'autres qui vont s'endormir puisqu'ils sont séparés ou concentrés leur âme afin d'écouter le chant. Donc, la concentration la plus intense porterait une espèce de d'état léthargique. Alors, ma question est la suivante. D'abord, je suis très ignorant, donc je ne sais pas exactement d'où elle était originaire, et s'il y a d'autres textes qui pourraient, comme évidemment Jean de la Croix participe à une sorte de tradition de conversos dont il avait à l'esprit tout le, je dirais, l'héritage, et je voulais savoir s'il y a d'autres textes et comment les interpréter, c'est-à-dire que le maximum de concentration mais dans une sorte d'état de suspension et de léthargie.
Yes, that's not a very original aspect of Alkabetz. The idea of concentration and lethargy is found in earlier sources, in Abulafia, and that Alcabets knew, but also many others. And the similarity makes between John of the Cross, one way to answer is very easy to say. Some scholars claim that he was a crypto-Kabbalist or had some sources of Kabbalah. And there are books about it, and I am very skeptical about it. Teresa Davila and he were of maybe vague Jewish origin, and people attempt to explain this by assuming that Kabbalah was known like today to everyone. That seems to me to be an easy but incorrect answer. The answer seems to me to be is they have common sources in Spain. Alcabet was born in Spain. He left as a child, basically, or maybe immediately after the expulsion from Spain, but he has good Spanish Jewish sources. Which means that we're speaking about, a Spanish background, which I would like with this occasion to offer a certain phenomenology, very stark, I'm sorry, that up to a certain century you have in Spain Muslim mysticism, almost no Jewish mysticism, and then we have Kabbalah, but Muslims disappeared, in Arabi left, etc. With the expulsion from Spain, the Kabbalists disappeared, by Christian mysticism emerged. In my opinion, we have these common sources. That's why I started by claiming the Kabbalists for sure had Arabic sources. That's no doubt about it. It cannot be a doubt about it. So that explanation will hold also for John of the Cross. Meaning those are part of what can be called the common background of the monotheistic mystics. Greek sources dealing with ecstasy and lethargy, which were dealt in different ways in the three forms of mysticism. And we shouldn't assume easy influences of one form of mysticism on another, but deal much more with, as I attempted to do here, with the Greek Hellenistic common sources, which were elaborated in different ways by the three major forms of monotheistic mysticism. And that will be my answer without attempting to deduce some form of Kabbalistic impact on. Alcabet was a little bit younger than John of the Cross, but I don't believe that is, important. They had sources which have to do with the Greek vision of ecstasy, which the moment of very deep concentration means that the soul is leaving the body, not to return to the source, and then the body remains in a lethargical state. So that I would say that is, the Greek heritage, which informed the three forms of mysticism.